Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
Hello, and our editor-at-large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
Hello, Happy New Year, guys.
Happy New Year to you.
Are we still allowed to say that? How long do we have to say it for? I don't know.
I think so. Just about.
Okay, so this week we are kicking off 2022 with a slice of licorice pizza, a soupçon of ear tickle with the electric life of Louis Wayne, a serving of kick-ass with the 355, a taste of chefing with Boiling Point, and we're finishing it all off with a hero. But before we get stuck into those, chaps, what have you been watching over Christmas? Christmas movies wall to wall, Jamie?
Yes and no, Jane. Yes and no. You know, I have a soft spot for Christmas movies. So from the 1st of November, I started, actually. I always wait till November. And then I've watched a Christmas movie most days, or certainly every other day since 1st of November. Most of them are kind of straight to Netflix. Christmas films they churn out every year, which are absolutely awful. Most of them. So I've watched an awful lot of crap the last 2 months. But to balance the crap, I've also treated myself to a Stanley Kubrick season at home.
Nice.
I've gone back and rewatched all of his movies. I've still got about 3 to go. 2001, The Shining and Full Metal Jacket. I still have to go, but I've watched everything else in the last couple of weeks and having an absolute glorious time with a bit of Stanley.
Bit of Stanley. Have you been having a bit of Stanley, Matthew?
Oh, very good. No, I haven't. I didn't watch a single Christmas movie, unless you count Spider-Man, No Way Home,
which is kind of is
Christmassy. Yeah, I went to see that again. Went to my son to see that, and he absolutely loved it, and he's become even more spider-obsessed than he was before he saw it.
Haven't we all?
Yeah, and he got very emotional as well at the end.
Mm.
Very, very emotional.
Yeah, so that was a little treat.
His favourite Spider-Man? Is it Tom Holland, because he's growing up with Tom Holland?
Yeah, it's either him or Tobey Maguire. He hasn't seen the Andrew Garfield ones because he's heard they're not very good, so he's not bothering with those.
I wonder who told him that, Matthew.
Yeah. I quite like the
first one. Who's editor of a film magazine may have had something to do with that. I've been watching a lot of sort of Netflix and Sky documentaries that I can just eat a bite-sized portion of. I don't have to watch a whole film. Yeah. I've given myself a film rest over Christmas. And I've been watching things like History's Greatest Mysteries, presented by Lawrence Fishburne, the Flight 19 Vanishing in the Bermuda Triangle Mystery, which actually proved quite interesting, because obviously the first I ever heard about that was at the beginning of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, if you remember, with the whole thing of like Flight 19 turns up in the desert and so do various ships that have disappeared, and it's because of aliens. So I had no idea. So I've been looking at that, and also the various murder things. I do like a murder documentary. So the torso murderer of Times Square.
Have you seen that? Is it good?
You'd like it, Jamie, because it's all about the dirty, filthy Times Square of the 70s. And the sort of mean streets, the taxi driver era of peep shows and pornos and just filthy. That's just your sort of thing.
I've heard about this documentary and the fact the serial killer is almost tagged onto it to get it made and for people to watch it, but it's more a sort of history of 70s Times Square when it was sleaze city.
So
that does very much appeal to me. I'm going to go back and wade through the sleaze without
It's only 3 parts, so you can get through that quite easily. So yeah, that's what I've been doing. Incredibly festive, I think you'll agree. Shall we get stuck into what we can watch in the new year then, because it is 2022 and we're kicking off with this.
To the seat with the clearest view, wow, wow, wow. And she's hooked to the silver screen.
Do you know who I am?
Yeah.
Do you know who my girlfriend is?
Barbara Streisand. Sand,
yeah, like sands, like the ocean, like
beaches. Barbicide sand?
No, but stray sand.
Sand.
So this is Licorice Pizza. Jamie, want to fill us in on what this is? Does it actually involve licorice on a pizza?
It does not. The title comes because we should probably say this. The title.
Yeah, you should, because I didn't know what this was.
No. Licorice Pizza is a name for a vinyl record because it looks like a pizza made of licorice, the sort of black vinyl. It's never discussed in the film. And the reason this film is called Licorice Pizza is because Paul Thomas Anderson, the writer-director, he used to go to a record store in the 70s when he was growing up in San Fernando Valley that was called Licorice Pizza. And it was his favorite place in the world. And when he thinks of his youth, he thinks of this record shop and all the nostalgia and all the happy memories that brings. So he called the film Licorice Pizza, but the film has nothing to do with it. You don't go to a record shop. You don't see any of that. So that's just a bit of background information. What it is, it's based in the 70s in the San Fernando Valley where Paul Thomas Anderson grew up. And it follows a young guy called Gary Valentine, played by Cooper Hoffman, who is Philip Seymour Hoffman's son. I think he was 18 when he made this film. And Philip Seymour Hoffman made 5 movies, I think it was, with Paul Thomas Anderson. So there's a bit of history there. And basically, Gary Valentine is at high school. He's 15 years old. And he's a bit of a kind of wheeler dealer. He has a gift of a gab. He starts all sorts of businesses during the course of a film. He starts a waterbed business and then a pinball palace. He's a bit of a kind of a entrepreneur in the making. And the film is about the fact that he falls for this 25-year-old called Alana Kane, who's played by Alana Haim from the, indie kind of rock band Haim. And she's 25 years old. She's at the school because she's a photographer's assistant. They're doing their school photos. He tries his gift of a gab on her, tries to chat her up and go out with her. And during the course of a film, it kind of tracks their relationship that they kind of migrate towards each other and then push each other away. They see other people, they kind of make each other jealous. But underpinning it all is this kind of sweet affection, romance between the two of them. And it's a really sweet, funny film. It's very freewheeling. It hasn't got much of a plot to it. It kind of stumbles along from one set piece to another, from one vignette to another. It's almost slice of life in a way, but it's just it tumbles through the summer of this San Fernando Valley in the 1970s. And what I loved about it is just the vibe and the atmosphere that it transports you to that time and place. You feel you're there. And I don't know what lenses or sound equipment Paul Thomas Anderson used, but it doesn't just feel like a film set in the 1970s in this place. It feels like an unearthed classic from that era, like we've suddenly found this film that I don't know if he used all the same lenses and everything, but it just absolutely looks and sounds like it was filmed in the 1970s in the San Fernando Valley. I absolutely adored it. I mean, Matthew, what did you think?
Yeah, same. Yeah, I adored it as well. Well, I've only seen 4 films that are out this year, but it's my favourite movie of the year thus far. Yeah. And I'm sure it will be high up on my top 10 of the year by the end of the year. Paul Thomas Anderson, I absolutely adored his last film, Phantom Thread. Yeah, it was just absolutely fantastic. It was all of it, right from the start, right from the bit, there's a cherry bomb incident right at the start. And I was just hooked in from there. I mean, it's very episodic. It's kind of one thing after another. You're never quite sure where it's going to go, but it hangs together so beautifully. And the performances are just fantastic. I mean, Alana Haim, I couldn't quite believe that it's her first. I mean, I know she is a performer, but her first acting experience in a narrative film. I thought she was incredible. She has such kind of natural charisma. Everything she does is just so compelling. She's just so brilliant in the whole thing. And there's so many great guest stars who pop up along the way. I adored it. I thought it was utterly fantastic.
Well, I mean, this is, for me, you know, Jamie and I discuss this all the time because Paul Thomas Anderson is his favourite filmmaker. And
working today, yeah.
Yeah. And I don't get it. I don't get it ever. So I watch his films and I admire them. So with this one, I admire the lensing. I admire the performances. I admire the costumes, like the attention to detail and what people wear, the attention to detail and stuff in the background, the production design. There's a section where Bradley Cooper turns up and instructs, you know, this kid how to say Barbara Streisand, and there's a bit with a truck that's reversed down a hill that frankly was the only part of the film that I was actually gripped by. But the rest of it, I feel like, am I not in on this joke? It feels very much like I'm not getting it, or that it's for people in a club. That's how it feels to me. You know, I think it's an admirable film. I kind of enjoyed spending time with it, but I find this wheeling, sort of not going anywhere, narrative incredibly frustrating. I didn't especially like anyone in it. I just didn't care. I don't get it, Jamie. I don't get it. What am I missing about this?
It's hard for me to say because the don't care bit, I just can't get my head around, because I care deeply for them. That I think Cooper Hoffman is such an engaging, warm, likable presence that I just loved him. Like every
I just thought he was a little shit.
No, every goofy grin he does, he's so impish, mischievous. And what I love about Paul Thomas Anderson is he often casts actors, and in this case, non-actors, that both his stars hadn't acted before in feature films. And they're like real people. They're not that Hollywood perfect teeth, like perfect skin.
Well, I mean, you know, perfect teeth is certainly not a requirement for this film.
No, they're just normal people. It feels like they're plucked off the street, and they just have such sort of charm and charisma. I love both the characters in this film and the other people who popped up. I found hugely colourful and engaging. The freewheeling thing, I can see what you're saying in terms of that won't be for everyone, that some people like a plot that drives you through the film, propels you, that you feel you're watching a story. You know, and this does feel like it sort of just stumbles along, and it takes time out. It has a breath with the characters. Nothing happens for a bit, and something punctuates the action, and it does happen. Personally, I found that glorious. Matthew sort of touched on it earlier, that he said he never knew where the film was going, that it was unpredictable.
Yeah.
As someone, you know, I watch so many films a year with this job and my obsession, that 9 out of 10, if not 99 out of 100, you know exactly where they're going. They follow certain formulas. And this film, you could stop like an hour in or 70 minutes in or 90 minutes in and go, what's going to happen next? How's it going to end? You just don't know. It does feel like he's just sort of filmed real life and stuff happens. And I loved it.
Yeah. And he introduces characters quite late in the day, like the whole political campaign subplot that comes quite late in the film, but it feels so fully realized. And I kind of got invested in those characters so quickly. He's just such a master.
Just was wanting like a mini film that was Bradley Cooper being nuts as this boyfriend of Streisand. Also just like he absolutely obsessed with like preying on women, which not that I'm saying I love that, but just it was comedic to me, that bit. And I loved, you know, the Hollywood idea of going up Mulholland Drive and up these sort of hills with this huge truck that was running out of petrol, and that background of the 70s where petrol was, you know, running out, which I think is very pertinent to us having had a little mini version of that recently. For me, there's bits I love, but it doesn't hang together, and it's not a film I'd ever watch again.
You see, I'm the opposite. It's a film I can't wait to see again. I'm going to get the Blu-ray, and I know now I will return to it again and again, which is something I find with PTA's films more than anyone else, apart from maybe Stanley Kubrick, to bring back Kubrick, who I mentioned earlier, that his films just reward repeat viewings, and you always see new stuff in there, and you get more obsessed with them, and they just kind of improve on each viewing, almost like listening to a great album, that it's just like one watch is not enough for me.
So, I mean, this just reminded me of Dazed and Confused. Like, why is this so much better than Dazed and Confused, apart from the snobbish value of the Paul Thomas Anderson? I'm not saying he's a snob, but there is an element for me that there's a bit of a, oh, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson, you know, I'm in the club with him and I like that. And there is a feel of a sort of like club about this. For me, you know, like I didn't really feel Dazed and Confused the same way. It's very similar.
I can see the similarity with Richard Linklater. I think what he does in a similar way is that you do have this kind of you invest in these characters and have warm feeling towards them, but he never kind of dips into sentimentality, which I think Linklater does brilliantly as well. And that he can make a film that doesn't have a particularly tight plot, but you are just following these characters, and that is the story in itself. So yeah, I think I could see connections there with Dazed and Confused and with the Before movies as well, in terms of the romantic comedy of it all.
But I love those films, and yet something about Paul Thomas Anderson leaves me cold, and I can't put my finger on it.
The Dazed and Confused thing, I think that's a good comparison, and for other people listening to this, and another good comparison is maybe American Graffiti, which was obviously George Lucas's second film. It's that kind of film where it just sort of follows the characters and suddenly shit happens and you follow them in a mini adventure, and then that ends overnight and they wake up the next day and then nothing happens for a bit. And It's one of those films, and I think they're very, very hard to do. And in some ways, they're the hardest films, the films where you feel they haven't got a plot, nothing happens. In some ways, you have to write them more specifically and be more sort of intense on your detail and your plotting than any other film, because otherwise you will just have a boring 2 hours of like nothing happening. So it's quite deceptive in a way. But I mean, I keep saying it, but I absolutely loved it. And I think all of PTA's films, we tend to think of his big, nasty or kind of, you know, tempestuous characters like Daniel Plainview and Freddie Quill in like The Master. And people think of PTA as this big, somber, serious filmmaker. But all of his characters are about misfits and loners and people struggling to fit in and connect. And there's so much heart and warmth in most of his films. And this one, more than maybe anyone he's made, I felt that. I just love these people. And I wanted them to get together, and I wanted to spend the summer with them, and I wanted to be friends with them. And Alana and Gary Valentine, you know, I just love them. They're great.
Let's see what other people think. Maybe it's just me. It probably is just me, but there you go. That is Licorice Pizza, which is out in cinemas on Friday. Next up, it's time for Cats, but not that one. This one.
I think you're the first person to see that cats are ridiculous, frightened, and brave. Like us.
Miss Richardson has had an incredibly positive effect on this family. Were you painting something?
Is something funny, Miss Wayne?
Not at all.
So this is The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne. Tell us about Louis Wayne, Matthew.
Well, Louis Wayne is a real person, was a real person in the 19th century. He's an illustrator who popularised cats, essentially, pictures of cats. He brought cats to the nation. And as this stars Benedict Cumberbatch, you could say this is the power of the cat. I don't know if you spotted my subtle reference there to a recent Cumberbatch movie. But yeah, he plays Louis Wayne, the artist. We follow him through a quite a long period of his life. I mean, it starts in classic biopic fashion with him in his old age, and we kind of look back on his life, the ups and downs, his struggles to get recognition, his various relationships, and lots of his pictures of cats. And it also stars as Claire Foy. She has a significant role, and Andrea Riseborough and Toby Jones. They kind of they all pop up along the way. And there's also lots of cats as well, as you would expect. So, I mean, if you're a lover of YouTube cat videos, and who isn't, then you're going to really enjoy this film, I think. And breaking from type, we have Benedict Cumberbatch as a kind of a socially awkward genius, which
hasn't done that one before, has he?
No, I was trying to think. Has he ever done that? I can't really think. Yeah.
It sounds like this is very much run-of-the-mill period drama with all the usual suspects and Benedict doing his usual thing. But it isn't really, is it? Did you enjoy it? I mean, you know, Olivia Colman doing this quite quirky voiceover where she's quite sweary and it's not sort of period appropriate. And this very sort of psychedelic sort of lensing and production design. Did you like it? Did you like that it sort of went away from the traditional period?
Yeah, I liked it to a point. Yeah, I wasn't crazy about it. But yeah, I did feel some of the quirks were a bit forced at times. But there are other quirks, like when the scene will kind of melt into a painting or vice versa. I enjoyed those. I really liked Olivia Colman's narration, most of the performances. But yeah, it did all feel a little bit forced at times to me.
I didn't like it. I know I may be on my own on this because I've seen a lot of positive feedback on Twitter and stuff. Most people seem to like it. But for me, like Matthew said, it just felt a bit too self-consciously quirky and forced and twee and kitsch. And I kind of get the fact that Louis Wayne's art of cats was also twee and kitsch. So they're kind of mimicking it in a way, and it kind of fits the tale to have these Dutch camera angles and a heightened palette and for everything to be a bit sort of crazy. And I do get that, but for me, it just didn't quite work, but it just left me cold. And Benedict Cumberbatch, he's one of those actors who in two or three roles, I absolutely adore him and think he's great. Like Power of the Dog, absolutely fantastic. But often he also leaves me a bit cold, that I do find he has this certain kind of shtick that he does. This film for me fell into that, but like we sort of touched on, that he's doing his eccentric kind of socially awkward genius. And it just all left me a bit cold, that I was never fully engaged in it. So it wasn't one for me.
Well, I disagree with you. I really enjoyed this. This sort of reminded me of David Copperfield that came out last year.
Yeah.
Iannucci's sort of take that was like, we're not going to do this clean. It's going to be sort of messy and playful and silly and mental and a bit sort of bonkers and off kilter. And everything you say about it is entirely true. It is twee. It is forced. It is all of those things. And I prepared myself to really, really dislike it. But all of those things, it sort of tipped over into the tweeness to actually enchant me, you know, particularly when Peter the kitten turned up. I mean, Peter's a delight. Yeah. I loved Riseborough in this as the sort of bossy sister. I thought Claire Foy was delightful. You know, people have been quite cold on her recent portrayal in A Very British Scandal of the Duchess of Argyll. This is her being so warm and so lovely and so different from the Queen. And this was a person I'd never heard of. I'd never heard of Louis Wayne and his... I mean, obviously, he's one of those artists where when you see the pictures, you're like, oh, I've seen those cats. They're like on biscuit tins and like on tea towels and stuff. It went everywhere. And that's the sort of thing that I found really interesting about this. Like this guy who never copyrighted a single image. And he drew with both hands and was sort of this genius, but stupid with money, absolutely hopeless, never made any money out of it, gave drawings away for haircuts and ended up sort of, you know, quite unwell with the sort of fizzing that was going on in his brain. But, you know, his art has gone, you know, through that sort of dip of being thought of as useless and ridiculous, multi-produced rubbish to something that's very collectible now. And like Nick Cave has a collection. I mean, if you want to know how cool it is, Nick Cave collects Louis Wayne. So I found all of that background really, really interesting. And yeah, and I sort of didn't mind that our good friend Benedict Cumberbatch was doing his usual thing, because I found him to be doing it delightfully in a much more entertaining fashion than he has before. And also I think it's such a completely different role from Power of the Dog. You know, Power of the Dog's Phil is this brutish, damaged person who is damaging other people and is horrible. And you can smell him off the screen. And Louis is this delightful, just wants the best for people, just broken in a way that is wonderful and just wants the best for everybody. So I really enjoyed seeing those two performances together. So for me, this was entertaining. I preferred this to Licorice Pizza, Jamie.
That's fair enough. It would be really boring if we all agreed. It really would.
Wouldn't it?
What I can get on board with Louis Wayne, though, because I didn't know anything about him either, so this film taught me quite a bit, is he believed that cats were evolving and that they would communicate with human beings like in 100 years' time or something. And I can fully get on board with that because I love cats. I love dogs as well. And if cats really are evolving, and if one day my cat turns around to me and says, "Oh, hi, Jamie, what are we watching this afternoon?" I'd be very happy with that. So I'm on board with that.
Oh, wouldn't that be lovely?
Yeah, and I also like that Louis has a cat voice that he talks to. He does the voice. I mean, anyone who has a cat has a cat voice. They're like, "Hello, could I have my dinner, please? I'm very hungry. I'd like a fishy." You know, we all have a little cat voice. So I felt like anyone who has cats would totally relate to this. And, you know, like that theremin soundtrack. I love a theremin soundtrack. I want to learn to play a theremin. Where do you even buy one? I would like that. Just delightful. But it is quirky with a capital Q. And so if that sets your teeth on edge, this is probably going to, isn't it?
We're in a good period for biopics of British artists, though, after The Colour Room and Mrs. Lowry and Son, recent examples. And they do feel like they're kind of pushing the boundaries a bit more, and they're not as stuffy as a lot of period dramas. So
exploring the sort of artistic urge of these artists, rather than just this man drew a painting and then cut off his ear. It's very much about the sort of the process of art and the sort of the feeling of art and how it feels to be sort of engaged in that process. Liked it. Okay.
And Mr. Turner, obviously.
And Mr. Turner, indeed. Okay, so that is The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne, which is in cinemas now. Sadly, you can't take your cat with you to a cinema, because I think cats would enjoy it too. Anyway, it's now time for a bit of plain talking, where we demystify terms that we hear on film sets. And this week, it's cherry picker. What's a cherry picker, lads?
I've got a vague idea, like a fireman's crane type thing. Is that right?
Yes.
I don't know why it's called cherry, though. What's it got to do with... Do they pick cherries like a lot on film sets?
Honestly, it's a cherry picker... That is a, you know, if you want to do your shot from on high or you want to do your lighting from on high, it's essentially a glorified crane that takes you up high. And it's called a cherry picker because you need them for picking cherries.
A cute name, isn't it?
That's what it is. An arm that goes up and down. And you could probably be a director shouting from the gantry of it if you so desired, if you had a cast of thousands.
What did, on the film Cherry, what did they call it? Just a picker?
Just a picker.
You know, the Tom Holland, it was just a picker. And I suppose, yeah,
no cherries in that film apart from that.
That'd be ridiculous.
Yeah. Okay, so it's time now to move on. You ready for some girl power with this?
Remember that story that they told us about in training?
About George Washington's first female spy during the Revolution. They called her Agent 355 because they didn't want the world to know her real name. But her legacy lives on. We're the top agents from around the world. American, British, German, Colombian, Chinese.
But now we have a common enemy.
They can start World War III from simple reach of their keyboard.
So we need to join forces.
So that is the 355, Jessica Chastain's like brainchild to create a film starring women, owned by women, and distributed by women, and so that the artists actually enjoy the benefits not only of the critical response but the monetary response to the film. Jamie, you saw it. Tell us about it.
Well, the MacGuffin of this film is that there's a hard drive that acts as a data key to hack into any closed system in the world. So basically, any technological system. And early in the film, it's demonstrated to us as a plane going by overhead, you know, many, many miles up in the sky, and they hack into the plane system and bring it down immediately. And so this is what you've got on your hands, that if anyone gets their hands on this, a kind of nefarious person gets their hands on it, it could basically bring about World War III. Mm-hmm. And it is so effective that it would not only bring about World War III, it would end World War III before anyone has a chance to fight back, because you can just hack into anything. So it's catastrophic. So the CIA obviously don't want this to happen. So Jessica Chastain, who is an agent in the CIA, is put into the field to try and track down this hard drive and bring it back to safe hands. Her partner is Sebastian Stan, who's also obviously in the CIA, and they go about their business. And early in the film, they basically discover that other teams are after this MacGuffin as well. The Germans are trying to get it in. Diane Kruger is the German agent trying to get her hands on it. The Colombians are after it in the form of Edgar Ramirez and Penelope Cruz. And Jessica Chastain decides that they need help, the CIA need help. So she contacts her old friend at the MI6, played by Lupita Nyong'o. And she's a surveillance expert, and she brings her into the team. So you've got all these different people trying to get their hands on it, and various bad guys as well. So that's what the film is about. As you can imagine, it's full of action set pieces. It's a kind of old school spy thriller in a way, action thriller. Lots of double dealing, double crossing. You never quite know who to trust. And that is what we're dealing with.
It's a Lady Bond.
Sort of, yeah.
Does it work on that level? I mean, obviously, the ambition for this is that it's sold to all of these territories. It's a completely global cast and it's intended for a global audience. Is that going to work?
Well, it may work in terms of it is a fantastic cast and there's real interest in that. And you undoubtedly get a thrill from seeing these wonderful women sharing the frame together. You know, they decide that in order to make sure this device goes into the right hands, they need to team up. So you've got all these amazing women, Jessica Chastain, Lupita Nyong'o, Penelope Cruz, Diane Kruger. They're all kind of acting as a super team in a way. So that's an exciting prospect. But unfortunately, the film itself isn't particularly very good. It starts off okay and it sort of raises the interest. And then the more it goes on, the action scenes are pretty average. They lack any real sort of punch or poetry. With exception of one scene, there's one really good scene in Marrakesh where there's big crowds and the ladies are surveilling their targets with the latest technology and they're sort of in amongst the crowds and trying to find these guys. And that's quite tense and well handled, but most of it is a bit kind of average, the action. And the women, even though it's amazing to see them together and to see them firing machine guns and, you know, you get a thrill out of that, they do, I feel, lack a certain amount of chemistry that you'd think having them together would be amazing. But for me, it just didn't quite spark. I mean, it's not trying to be Ocean's 8. It's not trying to have that banter, that repartee. It's played a lot more serious than that. It's a proper sort of action spy thriller. But it never quite leapt off the screen. There was something a little bit flat about it. It's quite hard to put your finger on.
Do you think it's because literally this was an exercise in marketing? They've sort of reverse engineered the film in order to get to the end product. Do you think that might be a factor?
It might well be, because I've got to say the plot is, I mean, there's so much double dealing and not knowing who to trust that it is really hard to follow at times, and not in a good way. I mean, a good spy thriller, you sort of, you don't mind the fact that the rug is totally, completely being pulled from under your feet at all times. But in this, there's sometimes there's so many different nationalities and people milling around and teaming up with different people that about halfway through, I really didn't have a clue what was going on. I was just like, I've lost this. And then I began to lose a bit of interest in it. So it could be that maybe they thought the idea was enough. And I do love the idea. I love the fact that Jessica Chastain is saying that all these actresses, they headline films and production companies, studios use their faces to sell tickets. And then the actresses don't get a fair share of the profits. So I love the fact that she's sort of with her production company, Freckle Films. She's built it from the ground up and she's attracted this cast through her contacts and they're all getting an equal pay, you know, from any profits that are made. So I love the idea of it, but it just doesn't quite spark. And I have to say, you know, at the end, rather inevitably, it's set up for a sequel. It very much leaves it that, you know, the team could get back together and go on future missions. And I've got to say, on the strength of this, I just can't see it being a hit and that sequel coming about, especially as right now it's up against Spider-Man, which of course is still two or 3 weeks in.
Absolutely. Sweeping up. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's going to be trounced at the box office. I really do. I'm sorry to say.
But for a point of view of, you know, female audience members who want to see themselves reflected on a screen and, you know, don't want to watch guys smacking each other about and a bit sick of seeing that, will it work on that level? I mean, Matthew and I, unfortunately, were not able to see this film. You're the only person that's seen it. But is it going to be something that, you know, people did enjoy seeing themselves reflected in Oceans with Sandra Bullock?
Yeah.
And Cate Blanchett. Is there going to be a certain thrill in that, do you think?
There is a certain thrill in it. Like I said earlier, when you've got these four women together, even though they didn't spark as well as I would have liked, but when you've got them together and they're all heavyweight actresses, and when they're gunning down guys, and there's, you know, later on in the film, they all get their hands on these big machine guns and they're spraying bullets. And that's definitely exciting to see that. And you want them to go out there and kick ass, and you want this film to be a success on that level. But it's just not quite strong enough. In fact, nowhere near strong enough, to be honest. I can't see anyone getting to the end of this film. And even with the excitement of those actresses, just thinking, oh, I love that. You know, I really hope they come back for more.
How does it compare to The Old Guard? I'm thinking of, you know, Charlize Theron there kicking ass as a sort of immortal warrior, which had an amazing action sort of segment in it. Quite a number of them, actually. And that's actually got a second film, even though, you know, people were a little bit lukewarm on it. You know, if that can get a sequel, maybe this could.
Yeah. Well, maybe you're right, because I didn't particularly like The Old Guard either. And I think this is at least as good, if not better, than The Old Guard. So maybe it can. But then if you compare it to something like Blonde Ambition, Charlize Theron, you know, that is far stronger than this, and the action set pieces are far better, and the character's better and more interesting and has more oomph to it. So so yeah, and even something like going back to that Angelina Jolie film,
Salt.
When she was trying to sort of do a female Bond type film, that wasn't particularly great and wasn't as good as we would have hoped, but that I would say is probably better than this as well. This just doesn't quite work.
What a shame. Had high hopes for this. Okay, so if you're interested in seeing these women take on the world, the 355 is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, it's time for alternative line reading. And this, I'm going to do this in the style of a serial killer. I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself, alone.
Oh my goodness.
What is it?
Is that a serial killer? That sounded almost like a kind of sexy, lusty voice. I can imagine Mickey Rourke in 9 and a Half Weeks kind of whispering. Yeah.
You can interpret it as that, but what is it from? You should know this, Jamie.
I know it. Do you know it, Matthew? Do you want to do it?
Yeah, is it The Master?
It is The Master.
Yeah.
Of course it is. It should be sung in a really annoying fashion that goes on for too long when you've already watched a 2-hour film and you're really ready for it to end.
Or alternatively, it should be sung at the end of a masterpiece in a really haunting kind of a just very, very moving way by Joaquin Phoenix, Philip Seymour Hoffman. I think it's a fantastic end to a brilliant movie.
Joaquin Phoenix is crying in that scene because he wants it to end. It sounds like this.
I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone.
Moving on. Service.
Andy.
Hello, mate.
Namaste, chef. Okay. Namaste. Good to see you, mate.
Yeah, nice to see you.
This is critic Sarah Southworth, as you know.
Hello, love.
Hi. Well, he's brought that shade of thing, giving him the food critic.
Mate.
Good to go. What's this all about?
This is about you taking £200,000 off me.
Sorry.
£200,000. Could just have a quick picture? A bit of a fun boy moment, but it's okay. Hey.
So this is Boiling Point. Jamie, who's in a Boiling Point situation here?
The person who's in a Boiling Point situation is head chef Andy, played by Stephen Graham. This is kind of one evening in his life. And the big thing about this movie is it was all shot in one take. So it's kind of real time and not one of those false one take movies where they hide cuts and they do all of that. It really was shot over 90 minutes, one take. And Andy, we meet him as he turns up to work and he's having a fraught conversation on his phone. And it's clear that he's got domestic issues. He's not in the best frame of mind, that his day is already going horribly wrong. When he turns up to work, it's a big noise at work. You've got the whole kitchen trying to prepare, get all the orders out, get the perfect food out. And on top of that, loads and loads of things happen. Like, first of all, there's a food inspector who's there that evening. So he's going around the kitchen and finding fault and saying, you know, you're not going to get your cleanliness certificate because this is wrong and this is wrong. His former boss, celebrity chef, played by Jason Fleming, happens to turn up that night with a guest who is a snobby food critic. So that obviously adds massively to the pressure of the evening. Other things go wrong as well. The maitre d' keeps allowing people to order off menu, which is the last thing Andy needs when he's so stressed and he's got so much to do, to have to kind of do dishes that aren't even on the menu. But the maitre d' insists he does them because his kind of various celebrity influencers on Instagram and stuff. So she doesn't want to piss them off. And so, yeah, that's it. It's kind of set over 90 minutes. And as you can imagine from that kind of summary, it's a very tense, intense film where emotions bubble to the surface and everything that can go wrong does go wrong. It reminded me a bit of Uncut Gems, that it doesn't let up for a minute.
Yeah.
One of those films where you're just on edge the whole time and kind of a... yeah, it really kind of gets the heart beating.
It does. I mean, we've seen this sort of stuff, haven't we, on Kitchen Nightmares and, yeah, and various reality shows, the sort of stress of the kitchen and how horrendous it is. But you know, the dynamics at play here, there's this back kitchen scenario, the pastry's kitchen, which I found a very moving little segment of this film. And that there is no crying in kitchens. There's no time for it. You have to get on with it and we're off. As soon as the door opens, you are off. Did you enjoy it, Matthew?
We'll talk about Hero later, but when I saw that, I thought that was the most stressful film I'd ever seen. And then I saw this, and this is the most stressful film I've ever seen. But yeah, I thought it was absolutely terrific. I was so gripped by it and just so mind-boggling how they did it in one shot like that. I mean, I thought it was more impressive than 1917, the way it just weaves in and out of these rooms and coordinates all these actors and them all hitting their marks and saying their lines and all this chaos that's going on with so many characters. Yeah, I thought it was fantastic. It's my second favourite film of the four I've seen in 2022, often. Licorice Pizza.
And Stephen Graham is just astonishing, as always. I mean, this guy, when is he ever bad? I mean, I loved him in Help. I thought he was incredible in that. And this is a sort of quite sort of similar role, in as much as it's a man who needs help and doesn't really know how to ask for it and is sort of just crashing through life. And it's very difficult for him. I thought he brought so much pathos to this and I felt so deeply for him. But equally, you know, as you say, it's not just about him. It's about this ensemble cast. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that his right-hand woman who is just trying to keep the plate spinning, literally, in that restaurant, I felt for her. I felt for his pastry chef in the back. I felt for the maitre d', you know, who, you know, has a heart and can be moved to tears. It's a wonderful, wonderful film. And, you know, we've all been in restaurants with those open kitchens and watched them sort of in wonder and wondered if they're having complete arguments over the Brussels sprouts, whatever it is that they're doing. I just find it fascinating.
Some of the diners as well are just hideous. I mean, like, I think, is it table 8 or table 9? I just absolutely was filled with fear every time they went near them. They were just ghastly, and those and the table of influencers as well. They just felt so horribly authentic.
But also, you know, the guy that's like, "Oh, I just brought a food critic as my date." It's like, come on! I mean, what? You know, it's just a big deal, and obviously, he's trying to say it's not a big deal. It is a big deal. You've brought a food critic to the restaurant. How awful is that on the night that things are going wrong and your turbot's gone wrong already? Your turbot dish is already off the menu. And also, there was an element of the comedy as well of the inspector, who is just this Jobsworth, which obviously they have to be so cleanliness is, but just he's like very, very patronizing. I'm sure they're not all like that, food inspectors out there, but it a really great film.
It won a couple of BIFFAs, didn't it, the British Independent Film Awards, including Best Supporting Actress and Best Cinematography, Matthew Lewis, which, you know, that is a selling point of this film, the fact that it's all done in one take. And like you guys said earlier, it's kind of mind-boggling how they did that. And I'd like to know how many times they had to do it to get it just right. You almost think, did they do it 200 times and someone, you know, kept messing up or didn't quite get it right? And on
got to pan in the background. Dong.
anything at all. But, you know, maybe on take 200, they said, right, that's the one, perfect. Or did they just do it in four takes? I don't know. But it's an incredible achievement.
I mean, I suppose people would say, you remember when they used to do ER Live or Coronation Street Live? Other actors are able to do this, so it's not that big a deal. And I suppose it is just like doing a performance on stage. You just have to go through it. But the technicalities of filming it is what makes it the tricky part. And going around then, you know, this camera does weave around through rooms, circle round tables, move outside the premises, inside the premises, out the back door. You know, you're everywhere with this. So the camera crew did a remarkable job on it, as well as the cast. So quite the achievement.
Also, it does fit the tone of the movie, but it's not just an ostentatious, like, you know, big flourish, like, look what we can do. It does serve a purpose that because it's all done in one take and the camera's moving around and, you know, there's no respite, it does add to the tension. And the fact that it is this evening in a restaurant and everything goes wrong.
Yes, indeed. So I think we're saying this is a Michelin-starred delight, aren't we? And not not a greasy spoon calf. So if you would like to see Boiling Point, it's out in cinemas and on digital on Friday. Also good not to watch on an empty stomach, I'd say, as well, because when they're plating up, my tummy rumbled. Okay, should we move on to our final film for this week then? It's this.
الان برای چی اومدید زندان؟
ولی خب شریکم پولم برداشت، برای همین نتونستم قسط و وام پرداخت بکنم.
مامان،
دایی اومده. چرا لاغر شدی دفعه؟ والا ما هر دفعه هم تنگ.
فکر نمی کردم اقدر بیتاقتت بشم.
دلم برای تنگ شده.
So this is A Hero, which won the prize at Cannes last year. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is the latest film from Iranian writer-director Asghar Farhadi. He's probably best known still for Separation, which was Oscar-nominated back in 2011. And this is the main focus here is this character Rahim, who's currently in prison for a debt he hasn't paid. And he's on a two-day leave. And he comes across this dropped purse, which happens to contain a huge amount of gold in it. And he kind of wrestles with whether should he take this money to pay off his debt or should he hand in the purse. And he ultimately decides on the latter. But then rather than his troubles getting easier from that point, they just get harder and harder and more tangled and involving more and more people. So
yes.
It gets into a very messy, stressful situation all round.
And you said this was like one of the most stressful films you've ever seen. And, you know,
yeah.
I think Jamie mentioned Uncut Gems as well, the Safdie brothers, similarly sort of man spiraling out of control. It really is quite the teeth sort of clenching watch, isn't it?
Yeah.
To see an act of, you know, kindness essentially be twisted by all sorts of social mores and petty sort of riffs and just sod's law to end up in a worse position. Did you like it, Jamie?
I did like it. I didn't like it as much as A Separation, which Matthew commented upon, which won the Oscar back in 2012. It won Best Foreign Language Film. I think that's still the highlight of his career. But this, it was really good. And like Matthew said, it was really tense. And he kind of makes these realist films that it feels very much shooting everyday life and normal people. And in this film, you know, he finds this money. And like you said, what impressed me is the way that everyone sort of jumps on it and different bodies kind of use the situation to their advantage. Like the prison where, because he's just on a two-day leave from prison. And when he finds this money and it's handed in and he becomes a bit of a celebrity for a while, the prison officers are kind of behind it as well. And they sort of bask in the acclaim and want the kudos. And everyone who gets involved are quite self-serving. And it was a really interesting film that kind of gripped me for 2 hours, but I don't put it on a level of A Separation. I mean, this one, I think it won second prize at Cannes last year.
Yeah.
The Grand Prix, which is the kind of runner up to the Palme d'Or, which of course went to Titane. But yeah, I definitely recommend you go and see it.
It's also really, you know, as you say, it's about everyday life. And this is a sort of everyday life that I don't see very often. It's Iran. You know, he gets off the bus and toddles off to this incredibly beautiful archaeological site, the tomb of Xerxes. And then he's sort of going home and, you know, I was like, what are they eating? What are they having for dinner? Oh, I fancy a bit of that. What's she serving up? And constant tea with tons of sugar everywhere you go. And the bustling sort of street life and different offices. And also just really interesting to see the way officials talk to women and the way that, you know, there's a scene in an office with a council official that he disparages, you know, the women in the office. And then when the men start to sort of say, excuse me, he then disparages them based on a totally different criteria as well. And they're sort of the weird social hierarchies that are involved. And it's sort of this clash, isn't it, of the very old and the tradition and the importance of your honor combined with what social media can do to completely erode your honor, how things look, how things are played, how things can be flipped, how it reflects on people. So it's incredibly modern, but also steeped in this really traditional way of life in Iran. And I really enjoyed that aspect of it.
It sort of reminded me of Ken Loach's movies where these characters are just constantly stuck in it between a rock and a hard place. No matter what they do, no matter how hard they try, there's always something getting in the way and thwarting their ambitions. Just so many complexities to juggle. I mean, it's just life, isn't it, really, that they're presenting to us?
Yeah. And also this guy's smile as well. Like, he has this smile that can light up a room at the beginning, and he's full of hope and the potential that he has ahead of him. You know, this, the potential for a new life with a new partner, the potential for a new start and a fresh beginning, this family life that he could have. And that smile just erodes over the course of this film. And it's really a study as well of how easily you can crush hope in somebody just by constantly beating them down. And that's not to say, you know, coming around with guns or roughing them up or anything, but just constantly taking that idea and slice of hope away from someone, and what that does to a person, to the point that, you know, the only thing that can raise him a smile in him, you know, towards the end of the film is a tray of baked goods that is given in kindness. And he has to start again with building that hope up. And I think that's something that, whether you've been to prison or whether you've been, you know, to the tomb of Xerxes or whatever it is, everyone can relate to that idea of hopes being dashed.
I just found it crazy that he was in prison to start with, that, you know, he's got debts, which...
Good debt, yeah.
Yeah, he just basically, you know, tried to make better of himself and make a life for himself, and then couldn't pay his money back. And then, you know, he's in prison, and then he gets his 2 days off, and again, you know, tries to improve himself, improve his life. And it is just how life gets in the way and how people can use and abuse you. And this director, he's very good on kind of social mores and corruption and political corruption, all of that, and how it can kind of beat the average man down. It's definitely a gripping, compelling film. Not exactly the most cheerful thing you'll ever watch, but you don't need that for more films.
Yeah. But it's interesting, there's no real bad guys in it either, is there? That even though these things are happening, you can completely understand the charity that feels hurt by some of his actions. You can completely understand the guy who's put him in prison. There's a point where he explains, you know, the money that he took to give to this guy that he never got back, what that means to him in his life. Yeah. And you absolutely understand his point of view as well. So it's such a sort of well-rounded and sort of empathetic film from that sort of aspect, isn't it?
That also works with the lead guy, Raheem, the guy who we're following, who hands the money in. You know, it's not as simple as he's a good guy either, that what he does when he hands that money in, that's a very good action, but it's not entirely selfless. You know, I won't go into it, but there's a moment where he thinks the money's worth a lot more, and, you know, he toys with the idea of keeping it and getting himself out of debt. Then he finds out that the gold coins actually aren't worth as much as he thought, and it will only do a small dent in his debt. So does he then hand them in just to sort of get some notice and get people to look upon him favourably? So even though he's lovely and you're fully behind him, and like you said, he's got a wonderful smile, and, you know, you really feel for him, it's not a case of, like, he is an all-round 100%
no,
good.
He's, you know, complex.
No, not cool.
Everything is grey in this film. Everything.
Yes. Yeah, it's a very ironic title, isn't it?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yes, indeed. So I think we could say that we are recommending this one quite highly, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Yeah.
So that is A Hero, which is available in cinemas from the 7th of January and on Amazon Prime from the 21st. So that is A Hero. Now, which was your film of the week, lads? Matthew?
Licorice Pizza. Followed by Boiling Point.
Yeah, my number two is Boiling Point, which obviously is all set in the kitchens. But number one is one thing they don't serve up in his restaurant, which is a slice of pizza. I'm going for Licorice Pizza. Won't just be my film of the week. I think it could well be my film of the year. And I say that it came out on January the 1st in cinemas. And as far as I'm concerned, everything else released this year.
You've peaked too early, Jamie. You've peaked too early.
It's all downhill from here, Jane. We've peaked. This is it.
My favourite was probably A Hero. I thought it was so interesting and complex and, incredibly relatable. Okay, so that is it for our first week of 2022. Just enough time, though, to remind you that today is new issue day, new issue Claxon. And the star of our new issue is Uncharted, the film starring Tom Holland and Mark Wahlberg, the adventurous Nathan Drake saga that is apparently a cross between James Bond and Indiana Jones. So you can have my money, gentlemen. Read all about that in the current issue. It's available on newsstands now. And if you want to get on board the Total Film train, we've got a special listener offer of 3 issues of Total Film magazine for only £3. I mean,
wow.
Bargain. Giving it away. When you're being, that's, you know, crazy. When you're being a bit tight in January after your Christmas spend, that's a bargain. So to get this special offer, go to www.magazinesdirect.com/insidepod and select your preferred subscription package. And if you do that, you'll get a magazine delivered to your door. You'll never miss an issue. You'll pay less than you would in the shops, and you'll get subscriber exclusive cover and content. So that website address again, www.magazinesdirect.com/insidepod. Right, before we go, we've got time for a reader's question. Ready for this? What yep. movie version of the future would you like to live in? Matthew.
I'm going to go for the recent Swan Song, because everything is really nice and clean, and the gadgetry is just fantastic. It looks like, you know, you can just play games at the drop of a hat and communicate via hologram, and yeah, it just looks like a really lovely utopian vision. So, and you can clone yourself, you know, if you've got the money. So yeah, I'm up for that.
Jamie, what about you?
Yeah, Swan Song's a good shout, because the vibe of that film is so lovely. It's really peaceful.
Yeah, serene. Yeah,
kind of watch it and you just, yeah, chill out for the whole film. I enjoyed that. But I'm going to go the exact opposite, and I'm going to live in the future presented in Blade Runner. I'm going to go the original 1982 Blade Runner, which was set in 2019. So it's kind of future past now. But yeah, that LA with its sort of neon and its smouldering skies and the endless rain and teeming streets and all of that. I'm going to go there. I'm just going to live a sleazy, dirty future.
I can see you with a big snake wrapped around you, kind of dancing.
Yes, yeah,
I'd have a big snake wrapped around me and
that's
nothing else.
Stuff of fantasies, the stuff
I would
of fantasies.
Be dancing in the streets. They'd lock me up.
Yeah.
The transparent raincoat running around.
Please, I don't want to think about Jamie in a transparent raincoat. Nobody wants to think about that.
Too late.
Yeah, so I so would not want to be in a road future or a Mad Max future or a Waterworld future. Why are they all so depressingly bad? So yeah, I'm going to go for the bright poppy, also obviously a bit bad in places, Back to the future. We could nice. Because who wouldn't want a hoverboard and lace up trainers that do themselves up and that cool jacket that Marty has? And having just been to see Back to the Future the musical, I'm well into my Back to the Future world again. So yeah, I'm going to go to Hill Valley and enjoy that. Although we've actually already passed that future place. Yeah. But for the purposes of this, when I watched that film, that was so far in the future, and those things could be true. Hoverboards are sort of true.
Hoverboards exist now, don't they?
Well, sort of, but not properly.
We haven't got everyone zooming around yet, but I think they have made them. So, yeah.
They must have them in the military, surely.
Well, they have those useless ones that go on water that are like just weird spouts that you seem to not be able to control, that you only see on You've Been Framed with people going wrong. But yes, that would be my future. Okay, so that is the end of this. But in our future, we have another podcast next week. And we also have more of the Total Film Last Picture Show, which Jamie is currently star of this week. But we'll have some special guests for next week. So do join us on both podcasts there, available on all good podding platforms. Now it's time to say goodbye, chaps. So do say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, all. To bite and scratch and scream all night. Let's go and throw all the songs we know.